Jim Bassett. We won't have time to play the complete Symphony of the Birds on this intermission broadcast, nor the complete explanation which precedes it. But hurriedly, you must hear the original bird calls from which the three movements were compiled, recordings of the songs themselves.
Thank you. thinking of her boyfriend who was down in this cave in. And he was down there, they said.
So, well, I got to make a
about all these Mayan cave-ins because there's so many accidents, you know, the conditions were very poor. So
they used it as a theme for it, you know, the strike.
So who wrote the music? Did you have composers?
Well, they had composers. I don't know who. I can't remember who they wrote them, but they wrote the story.
Yeah, well, you see, they send to New York or someplace for, they send us a whole list of plays and tell us, have a little synopsis about each one, what it was about and how many characters, how many men, how many women, and it's so that you could decide if you could put on, if there were too many characters you didn't think you could put on such a big one, you'd pick out one that sounded like you could produce. And then, so we sent for that one. So then we don't know, then they send us the roles, you know, all the parts, the main, the master one, and then all the ones for the different characters, and they were all already done,
ready.
See?
Ready.
Yeah, oh, they had ready
library.
Well,
you were in a five-act play. What was that one? The red. That was a big play.
Oh, well, that may have been the one I'm talking about.
Yeah.
Man Umanisa was the name of it, which means in the bowels of the earth.
Bowels of the earth, yeah.
You know, meaning down, way down in there, you know.
That was about a three-hour play.
Well, it was a long play.
Long.
A musical. It was like a tragedy. Well, there was a strike involved in it, and all the people, the strikers were there. It had quite a mob, you know. I mean, a lot of people.
Yeah.
I couldn't call it a mob.
Do those plays exist, do you think?
Oh, I imagine they
do
still have.
Do those plays exist?
Yeah, they still have them, I'm sure. But the thing is, the people that perform them have died off.
Or they play it all over the country.
And then we tour with the plays in many different towns through the countryside, you know, and
Minnesota and Michigan, I both.
Yeah, Minnesota, Michigan.
Yeah, most of them.
Well, you show that one place. You must have showed it many places.
Well, then there was another play that I was in, that the Finnish Civic Club, that was composed of, well, not the left Finns, you know, but
the right and the left, both.
Well, sort of together, and there were a few of the left ones in there. Remember Herman Cordesoy, one of our people, was joined that outfit, and they wanted to put on a comedy, a play, and he asked me if I would take part in it, and I said, well, that was when you were at the party, too. And I didn't have too much else to occupy my time, anyhow, I was working, but otherwise. I said, well, if it's okay with the Finnish Civic Club to have me in it, I told him, I said, I'll be glad to be in it, you know. He just laughed. He said, sure, it's all right, you know. So we got together with these people that we ordinarily, I wouldn't ordinarily not have gotten together with, you know, otherwise. And through that, you know, you kind of cement relationships with them. And it was a comedy about Viisi Tuhatta Viisi Satakun Viheltämällä. That's a long name, you know. But 5,500 as though whistled. Now that sounds crazy.
Yeah.
And I can't even remember what it was all about.
As though whistled.
Yeah, it was just thrown away as if it was nothing.
Oh, I see.
Something that's what it meant, you know. But it was the funniest thing I remember. It was awfully funny. that went on a pretty big, and that was shown in the Socialist Opera, and that was in 1938. So it was still being used as a cultural center in at that time. So it was about a couple of years later, I think, that they converted it to a commercial.
Yeah. Oh, that's a
See, I remember when I was a kid about, I must have been 7 years old, I remember when the red flag used to be flown on the Socialist Opera. Red flag and American flag was always there. And I remember when the National Guard came there one day, and I was there watching. And the argument was over the question of whether the red flag was higher than the American flag. It had to be lowered.
Well, that was actually subordinated, you know. And at least they didn't tell you to take it down all the way. And well, I was only a kid, but I can remember even the one of the marches, my mother used to march, and my mother used to push the buggy baby buggy, my younger brother, and go all the way. That's 7 miles out there.
Yeah, to
everybody marched all that 7 miles.
I remember I was in that march.
Yeah.
And that was it was near Everett, the picnic ground out there. And Everett is about 4 or 5 miles from Virginia. And then after you get to Everett, it was a couple
about 3 miles. Yes.
2 or 3 miles out into the
lake shore.
By the lake shore there.
The big picnic ground, and we used to march for miles and miles, the whole range marched.
And I think we were both in that march, but of course we didn't know each other.
They would march together, they would be in kind of a formation.
Oh, yeah. We met first at this opera house, you know, everybody came there, and that's where we started from. Well, all people had to bring their kids, and nobody had cars. I told if a few did, maybe they drove, but the rest who didn't, they walked. That was the only way they could get there.
And they came from Hibbing, 30 miles away. They came, I don't know how they
came. I suppose they came, by train or...
Or horse or something.
They had trains.
Trains, you know, yeah. They came all the way to Virginia, and then we marched all the way from there.
Mm-hmm.
And it was miles and miles long.
I even walked then. I was just about 6 years old or something like that. 6 or 7.
Then you had to walk back.
Yeah, how did we get back? I don't know. We walked back, but I can remember there used to be a big thing always to it, you know. That was May Day.
Mm-hmm. That was a May Day.
May Day celebration.
And the people, that's when all the Finns were together, yes. But then later on, there became the split, you know.
So the crossing.
And I can remember the women had a athletic organization then.
Yeah, the women had athletic organization.
Where they were.
And the men did too, you know. Women.
Yeah, they had their separate ones, and the women had, I remember they wore white outfits, like these wide bloomers, you know, they used to wear, and white middies with the red ties, and then they performed during the picnic, and there was a lot of them there, and they'd march in formation, and then they did their calisthenics, you know, and they had a band, a big band.
Well, every community had a band.
The band would play throughout the whole affair, and I think they played the music so that the calisthenics were done in rhythm, you know, from the music.
Yeah.
And then, of course, they had their speakers and their horns and their singing and all that, you know, and I remember all the pop is when I remember.
You
pop. And ice cream and that, of course, that's just taken for granted.
No, but we hear it one day, we were at talking about it, you know, I attended the Finnish, Sunday school.
Oh, that's what I was going to
say. Yeah, I attended the Finnish
Sunday school. So did I, and I think we were...
At the Socialist Opera, they had a Sunday school for kids.
Not a religious
thing.
Mm-hmm. On Sunday?
So, yeah, on Sunday. This is Sunday. This is the Sunday school, and they taught you the alphabet and the
and we had a book.
Well, we still got the book around, and somewhere around
ABC of Socialism or something like that, you know.
It's a really remarkable, with pictures and everything. The boss, the worker, and everything, you know.
There are pictures in there about a mine accident, and they were carrying out a worker that had been injured on a stretcher, you know.
Yeah.
And cop standing by watching or something. I always remember looking at that picture because I remember my dad was hurt, you know, in the mine that way. And I was just thinking, Matt, that might as well be my dad right there, you know. And so then at the same time that we learned how to speak and write the Finnish language, why, then we also learned about socialism, the class struggle.
This Sunday school taught the Finnish language, too.
Yeah.
Yeah,
the Finnish
language.
And Otto Wallin was the teacher. He was our teacher. And then we had to write stories in Finnish then, and he would correct our papers as to spelling and formation of sentences and stuff like that.
So you see those years, then we began to talk about it, and I think I was in the same class as the Tony, but I didn't know her.
Yeah, we were just little kids.
Later, I met her afterwards. Darn period, you know.
Did you have a lot of kids in the Sunday school?
Yeah. Well, this Eileen Kosky at her home, there's a picture of all of us taken on the steps of the socialist soccer. And the last time we went there to visit Eileen's mother was just very recently, and we were asking her to see some of these pictures. But, you know, she had put them away someplace because she was counted on account of being foreign-born and not a citizen. So she was one of those cases. He never did get
Dick has a lot that his mother had. When his mother died, he's got a whole bunch of them in his house.
Oh, Rick LaFranca.
Yeah.
His mother died last year.
Yeah, not too long ago. Well, she was another good wrote
yeah,
the Finnish paper.
She was writing for the paper when she died. You know, there's something about the position of women in the Finnish movement that is something I never see anywhere else. You know, like the women write for the paper, all these women that you speak of, Rick's mother and... where does this come from? There seems to have a real equality.
You know, another person that wrote for the paper all the time, constantly, is Walter Reed's mother.
Yeah.
And they have her letters, and Julia has...
She's a writer. That's the biggest circulation among the Finns.
I don't know, any other radical movement, it seems to me, has so much expression in the women in it.
Well, I don't know why that developed, because I think it was a real fight for equality among women, because the women were really kept down in Finland, you know.
Well, they were true anywhere, but the women
were
everywhere.
And when they came to this country, there was really a struggle on that. They must have been tremendous struggle.
There's much greater radical movement in this country, you know, where the women never had very much, in the socialist movement, the women, you know, really never developed, or were developed in that. You see these women everywhere, like this woman at Ogama that died.
Kosky.
The whole community talked about it.
He was a leader of the whole community.
Yes.
Mrs. Kosky.
What's the person?
Oh, I forget her first name. She was originally from Markham, and they moved down there to Strawberry Lake up there in Ogama. Mm-hmm. And she was the leader. She was the leader in the community there.
Oh.
Everybody looked upon her as the main person, men and women.
Yeah. There's so many of those kind of women in this.
Well, you take Lizzie Anderson, Jenny Trask, all of these women looked upon her.
I know. And Siri Anderson, of course.
Siri Anderson.
She's dead now, but there was another speaker, and boy.
Oh, she was horrible.
And then Mrs.
Viney of that.
And Mrs. Viney of that.
Dead now too, but she was really right.
We should get to some of those letters and things of these women for our book and translate. Don't you think? We have one of the weaknesses of this book is the lack of women in it. We don't have any women. Well, we got Susie and myself. From a couple of poems.
Huh?
Well, I've always struck me in the Finnish movement. I just can't understand. They have such an equality.
Yeah.
Piccolo.
Well, you know, like having an athletic organization.
Yeah, these women's athletic organization. I can still remember standing there and watching just the awe, you know.
Well, you can...
such a beautiful thing.
Excuse me. No, we don't have a history. But it developed...
Well, I know that Carl told about the men's organization, how they had competition between Michigan, Minnesota, Nebraska, I think was the thing. You know, were they heavy athletic competition?
Well, that's another period, you know. Then when we got a little older, we developed the Labor Sports Youth Club. Labor Sports Club.
Labor Sports Union.
Every community had a Labor Sports Club. We lived in Cherry, that's all, and I, you know.
Where's that picture?
And well, when is that picture?
Well, you're staying talking.
So we developed these labor sports clubs all over every community. Well, we had 60 members in our club. Mm. Young people, everybody in the community, all was in that club.
Mm.
Youth club. We had high bars, everything. Mats. We did calisthenics. We did high bar work and track work and everything. Twice a week every summer. And then there was competition. We had competition. We had picnics and everything. And, tremendous thing.
Mm-hmm.
Why, I think there were 3,000 members. 3,000 members in the sports club that just in Minnesota, Michigan, and Wisconsin.
I think that's very important for Mr. Popovich to know. I mean, that's part of the Minnesota culture. It involves a lot of people. I think that it's... our culture is so kept to pieces, you know. I mean, there's no unified culture in the state. I mean, all the church culture is one culture, and the national culture is very... Well, like the Turnarounds, the German Turnarounds are a radical organization, very similar to that. In St. Paul, they had a great big building, and they were the 49ers, you know, most of them.
The only trouble was, you see, that it was narrow in the sense that it was only 10. The children of 10 were all in honor of these clubs. Well, the YCL tended to be the same thing. YCL, of course, was smaller. You know, it was mainly of the more advanced. It was more advanced. And, Labor Sports Club, everybody participated. It was broad in that sense that it took all of them.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a sport organization, not a political, but it was a sport. But it was political, too, because the YCL directed the whole thing. YCL was responsible for directing the Labor Sports Union.
Oh, they could have organized it and directed it.
Yeah, they directed it. We used to, I know, the YCL, and the YCL got involved. We directed the whole Labor Sports Union. We had a full-time director on the Labor Sports. Paid them $40 a week in those days. $40 a week, imagine. We had a heck of a time raising the money. So we'd go on exhibition tours, calisthenics, high bar work, pyramids, and put on tremendous shows, you know. Travel every summer, every Finnish community, all summer long. Then we charge admission, raise the money in order to pay our director and pay the expenses.
Wouldn't it be wonderful if the trade unions did that now?
Oh,
I mean, that's something a trade union could really make a community.
I remember a May Day demonstration in Hancock, Michigan. I was there and we had a demonstration, about 3,000 people participated. Then we had the latest Labor Sports Union there. From every community was there in their uniforms, white uniforms and a red sash, around here. And they marched on the side, and they had everyone had a little birch club, you know. And on the birch club was a little sign, some slogan. These birch clubs were just their weapons. And we marched through that city, and the American Legion tried to destroy that march, and they couldn't do it. We marched throughout the city for, I think, 4 hours, and we went everywhere. It was a tremendous thing. I remember Snyderman was there. Oh, that's where I got beaten up. attack sniper in there, but we had to defend them. I was in the front. Oh, well, did I get a... I was really keeping up there.
Is that the American Legion?
Yeah, the American Legion, yeah. But
did they try to stop you from the
mud? Oh, they tried to stop it with the fire department, with water and everything.
Oh.
They tried to man, they had rubber hoses and everything.
But you just kept on it.
Well, we kept on marching and all right. And that march never faltered, you know. I remember, you know, we were marching and we had orders. Nobody break line, you know, just keep marching. And we had a band. But then we had about 20 of us in front, you know, Labor Sports Union guys. And Bill Snyderman, Jack Anderson, myself were in front. First three guys, and we marched, you know.
Snyderman isn't a fan, is he?
No, he was not. He was a district organizer.
Oh, I
party, and he came out there to speak, you know, he had a march. And they were gonna attack Snyderman, and I had to defend. I defended them. You know.
What happened to you after you were beaten up?
No, I got my cheek was all broken up, and I got the rubber hose on the back. You know, I was black and blue all over.
He's a minor
man.
Oh,
well, that's later. That's a later period.
Just inside the range, slot between the truck and his Martin, and
Martin Gusisto. Martin Gusisto, who's a woodworker's organizer right now. And there's a guy by the name of Jack Anderson, who used to be a co-op manager for Greenwood. That's the big hunger mother. There's 1,500 farmers marched from St. Louis County from the range to Duluth that night.
So this is 32
or 3? This is 30,
That's the reason you remember the date.
34, right? 32?
Could it be that late?
32 or 33, somewhere around there.
Yeah,
32
or
33, yeah, when Martin was 1,500
farmers.
Yeah.
Why? What did you do when you got to Duluth?
Well, we had a committee we went before the county commissioners. The county commissioners had their headquarters, the courthouse in Duluth, and that's where we had.
Hello, Tony. Were these farmers?
Yeah, all these farmers were there.
And we thought we might be able to use that picture if somebody could write a story.
I wish we did have a story. Isn't he beautiful?
He was a real farm organizer.
See, on the back of it says Madrid. That was taken in 37.
Horrible.
I don't know who wrote that
thing. Carly, you said he was only 32, was he? Was he that young?
He's younger than I am.
Say, we have some letters that he sent us. Why couldn't we just publish the letter? That's enough.
Harry told some wonderful stories. Couldn't we have some stories about him just from people? Harry told the most wonderful stories about his organizing ability.
Yeah, he was mostly a farm organizer, and that's when he toured around the country.
Isn't he? That's a wonderful
picture. Yeah.
He toured around the country. Yeah, I think he used that. It has all the feeling of...
I think so. Everybody would appreciate seeing it, too, because...
I think we should. That's a good... Isn't it funny? I never had an idea of what he looked like.
Oh, is that right?
But I've always heard so much about him.
Mm-hmm. You'd get up and speak, and what was his background? I mean, he was anti...
No, he used to be very anti-communist, anti-socialist. And I... He was a farmer's son. He was a small farmer's son. And he used to do logging and so on. And I don't know how I met him one day, and I got into a discussion with him. And I argued with him and fought with him. And you know, I convinced him, and I recruited him in a party. He put everything in it. Everything. He had about $600 saved up, and he used all of that in organizing everything. He put everything. So I told life into him. Yeah.
You know, Vienna tells about how he used to drive around with her mother.
Yeah.
organizing a fire, man.
Yeah.
I wish you could have gotten Vienna to tell something about the mother.
Oh, he liked everybody among every word he mentioned. But he was the most, I used to tell him,
yeah.
You know, that Ray, you're the most abstract-minded guy I ever seen. You know, he would be in Virginia and he had to go to a meeting 100 miles away. 2 o'clock in the afternoon, I'd say, Rayno, he was supposed to be at a meeting 100 miles from here. Oh, he said, don't worry, I'll get there. How are you going to get there? And my God, he had a hitchhike, and he always got there.
Mm-hmm.
One day he left, and I began an inquiry from the other people. I said, where did Rayno go? Oh, he went out deer hunting. Well, where the hell did he get a gun? Oh, he borrowed so-and-so's gun. He said, borrowed Anderson's gun. Mm-hmm. And he went out, and sure enough, this was during the depression. He shot 2 deer. And he brings the meat, and then when he comes back at about 8 o'clock, and I said, where the heck you been? I went deer hunting. I said, why the hell did you go deer hunting? Well, people need meat. And he brings the meat all cut up, and he distributes it around to everybody. Illegally, too, you know. Then I says, what about the gun? Oh, my gosh, I forgot the gun.
He was kind of absent-minded.
In that sense, you know, he just went after one thing and he forgot the gun. And he left them out in the woods. I said, my God, you found the guns. You got to bring those guns back. The next day he goes out and he couldn't find them. He couldn't find them. It was a good gun, too, and he couldn't find it. Somebody had found it.
So then when he went to Spain, I wrote the letter to him, see?
Yeah.
And I said, for heaven's sake, Rayno, don't forget your gun.
Don't forget your gun. And then he writes the letter to him.
Yeah, he writes back. I think he mentioned it someplace.
Yeah, he said, I won't forget the gun.
Oh, I think that's a good idea.
May I draw some more pictures of that hunger march in Duluth, where they congregated at around some court, in the courthouse square there?
Oh, see, this is a good
picture. Yeah, they're marching
in. And wouldn't that be good for the book?
That's what I'm thinking, these are good enough
to make cuts.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, to give that sense of that.
Yeah.
Those are wonderful.
Yeah.
Don't you think we should do it?
I took those pictures.
Wouldn't it?
When Duluth sent the big delegation to that peace conference in Chicago, and they hired a Greyhound bus, you know, and they had this big sign on the side of the whole bus about the peace conference Chicago and so and so. Well, I had taken a picture of that bus in Chicago with my little old 98 cent camera, you know, that I was about 25 years old, but that's what I took those pictures.
Oh.
And they had heard that I had pictures of it. So they wrote to me and asked me, and I sent my snapshots to them, and they published them in their, either in their Christmas or their May issue, I don't know. It must have been the Christmas issue, because May was already gone, you know, for that year.
I think this would be produced.
So they were able to do it.
I think for this long line.
I think so,
And then, of course, these bigger ones, might be easier to do, I don't know, but...
But they don't give a sense of mass, just gives that sense of going through the country.
Here it shows the cops,
We were arguing with them because they wouldn't allow us to go down the street we wanted to. They made us go along the street, and I was arguing with them. You see them, I'm kneeling down there arguing with them, fighting with them, telling them, calling them off. I can't remember what the hell I said, but I was... boiled up because they wouldn't.
Oh, they had a fire department already.
Oh, yeah. The whole city force was there trying to stop us coming in.
Well, what did you do then? You had your committee?
Well, then they allowed us to go along a certain street down to the courthouse. They wouldn't allow us to go down the main. We wanted to go down the main street, Superior Street, but they wouldn't allow us.
Well, we could, more people could see.
I think they let us go along Fourth Avenue then.
Oh, yeah. Finally ended up at the courthouse further.
Yeah.
Well, I like to use this picture in the march. You know, coming across the country, there's something about that.
Yeah, just take those. Yeah, that's coming across from Duluth Heights, coming from the range.
This is the head of Lincoln, isn't it?
That's made out of snow.
That's in the city of Virginia.
One of the kids in school. He was a regular, he was a real artist, you know, and a sculptor and whatnot, you know. Just a young kid, and it's a huge thing, really. It's much higher than a human being.
The nicest faces of Lincoln.
Yeah, it was in front of our school building. This kid made it. So.
Oh, for a minute.
Yeah.
Oh, I'm at the top of this. You don't know a thing about the people who are white.
Oh, here's the here's a letter from...
We could even use that, maybe.
Reno.
Picture up.
Here's a letter from Reno.
People can make.
You see, they used to call me, I had a nickname, they used to call me Patty.
Patty
and Tony.
Patty McKay.
So he writes, dear comrades, Patty and Tony. Sure felt tickled to get your letter, which I received today. This is September 17, 1937, from Spain. As you know, letters from comrades back home are more than welcome here. Your letter has been passed around among many of the boys, including Martin Mackey. Oh, that's little Marty.
Yeah, the other Martin.
Who read it together with me when I opened up the envelope. Martin Cusisto is in the artillery somewhere in Spain. None of the boys that I know of from Minnesota have been either killed or wounded to date. They have been very lucky. I only hope our luck holds out. I'm sure looking forward to receiving that package, especially
I told him I'm sending him a package.
Sink my teeth into those chocolate bars. Of course, the socks and mitts will come in mighty handy, too, with the cold weather setting in until... I've been swamped with demands for those cigarettes when they come. He didn't smoke, you know, so they wanted somebody else. Mighty glad to hear of the progress made on the range in organizing the miners. See, I was on the organizing staff then. It's about time the proletarians of the range towns woke up and took their historic place as leaders of the toiling masses of both town and country. As you know, it's been the farmers in the, on the range that have stayed in the leading part, so in the revolutionary movements in the past. More power to you and your organizational work among the miners. I sure hope we get the chance to see Bernard when he comes to Spain.
Did he go?
Yeah, he went. We from Minnesota will have plenty to talk about with him. Perhaps by this time you will have read about the recent victories of the Loyalist forces in the Aragon front. I can't refrain from having my say as the International Brigade played an important part in the successful offensive. According to official government reports, we took more than 3,000 prisoners, more than 350 square miles of territory from the fascists. Many cannons, tons of ammunition, thousands of rifles, and so forth. The towns that we took were so well fortified that at one town in particular, the fascists bragged in Addis broadcast we would never take it, but due to very good military strategy and tactics, these towns fell into the hands one after another with very little casualties on our side. He goes on. It was a rather risky business for our Finnish section to take these prisoners as they came towards us fully armed with rifles, hand grenades, and bayonets. It so happened that these several hundred prisoners happened to come down the hill directly on that side of the hill where we were stationed, so there was nothing else that we could do but take the full responsibility of capturing these prisoners, regardless of the consequences, as there was no possibility of getting more help just at that moment. Seeing that we would not harm them, with arms uplifted, they came towards us. A lot of them were just kids, 15 to 16 years old, having been forced by Franco to take arms against the loyalists and join the fascist army. Viva Republica! Many shouted as they raised their fist in giving the loyalist salute as they advanced. They were haggard, tired, thirsty, and awful nervous. We had them lay their rifles, bayonets, ammunition, and hand grenades in a pile when they got closer to us.
We were waiting and wondering what has happened to me. Late to you, you never late, you know, he's always come. And finally he came, him and was it Jack Anderson,
Jack Anderson
and
yeah.
maybe one other person.
Yeah.
They finally got there and we asked him what happened, you know, and he started telling us about the wonderful meeting he had been at. And, you know, it was just...
half an hour he reported on the meeting.
Yeah, so then when he got through his, oh yeah, and we almost got killed.
We got inside. What happened?
Yeah.
Well, he said, well, a train hit us.
Their car and dragged them about half a block someplace, you know, and the car was...
all demolished.
Demolished into pieces or something.
This was not important. You know,
that was incidental.
The meeting
was
the
important,
important
thing. That's how wonderful it was. That's why it was lazy. They hit by a train. everybody laughed about that, talked about that, you know, for a long time afterwards, how that was just a...
Before you told the story about how he was at a state committee meeting, I guess, and he was supposed to go, and it voted that he should go and organize the farmers in some district that was, and so before the meeting was over, somebody says, where is he? And they said, he's gone to organize the farmers. He left immediately.
Another thing too that happened was when there was a farmer's milk strike. Now I don't remember the details of that, but he had been arrested anyway in Virginia there in connection with this milk strike, and here he was in court trying to fight his own case. You know, we didn't have any money. He didn't have any money to hire an attorney or anything. And so this attorney that I was working for, who didn't know much from nothing, you know, as far as politics was concerned, he happened to be in the courthouse on some other business of his own, and he looked in on this case, you know, that was going on. Here he sees this guy trying to defend himself, and he goes up to him and tells him, he says, well, if you want some help, you know, if you want me to defend you or help you, he says, I'll be glad to do it, there'll be no charge. And he probably listened in on it enough to gather what was going on, see, and maybe he... He was a sort of a sympathetic fellow, you know.
At that time,
he wasn't bad at all. So Reina says, okay, and he goes in there, and they have a little consultation, I suppose, and then he goes in there and defends this guy and gets him off scot free, see. So that, they became friends, see.
Yeah.
And then this boss of mine, he comes and tells me about this, and then I hear it from Reina, too. And I was so happy to hear that, you know. And so then sometime later when he was stuck way out in the country somewhere, he'd gone out organizing farmers or working on something like that, he writes to this boss of mine, you know, and he says that, here I am, way out in the country, and I'm stuck, I don't have any money, and I've got to get back into Virginia and keep going, or either keep going or get back into town or something, and he didn't have any money, and asked him if he couldn't send him a little money, you know. So my boss looks at the letter for a while. He shows it to me, too. I was just wondering what he was going to do. He says, well, send him a couple of bucks. But then, so I suppose at that time it was maybe a little bit something, you know, nowadays it would be anything. But so I was hoping it could be more, but I was happy it was something, you know, to think that he'd even do that. So I made out a check and mailed it to him.
Yeah, I sent him to Bemidji one time to, I don't know, some meeting, and he got arrested there, too. Oh, he was arrested often, you know. So he got arrested, you know, with a couple other guys. was a jail out there, you know, as such, you know. So when he got arrested, you know, so he goes to the back window, the bars, and he began to speak from there, and the whole crowd out there, you know, and he spoke to him, continued speaking, you know, and he had a, and really something, you know. And he was constantly, you know, always being arrested for something, you know.
And one time he spoke at some meeting at a farm somewhere, and he addressed the crowd. I think it was in he spoke in either English or Finnish.
Yeah.
Finnish,
yeah.
Well, that time it was Finnish, but he said, Soverit ja nälkään kuolevat farmer. That means comrades and farmers dying of hunger.
Dying of hunger, yeah.
That's the way he addressed it, you know, instead of ladies and gentlemen.
Was he a good speaker?
Oh, he was a good speaker for among farmers. He was a simple
especially
speaker.
Amongst farmers, you
simple,
know. They understood his language
speaker.
And
his language is very simple. Not
nothing highfalutin.
Nothing
down to earth, you know.
Down to earth.
Which you need from that sort of thing.
He was a real down-to-earth farmer. There's no other
farm
there.
Well,
he
was raised and born and lived on his farm.
Yeah.
Are there other children in the family?
Oh, yeah, it was a big family.
Yeah. There's a big family.
And all the children were.
All were simple.
They were all in the movement.
Including their grandparents, one of them. Oh, I better not mention it. Is here in Minneapolis by the meeting.
Not grandparents, grandchildren.
Grandchildren.
One of them.
Oh, who is this on the
that's Martin.
I used to be an acrobat, don't you know that?
Yeah. I think she was. Here's another one. Here was it now. He climbed way up on top of a
windmill car. This is Napoleon here, see.
Is this you?
That's Napoleon.
Yeah, that's him.
See the hole in the shoe?
The way he looked, you know.
You were blonde?
I was blonde, then.
Yeah,
maybe.
Well, that's him, too, climbed way up on the
wall. Oh. Is that the windmill car?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Did you take all these pictures with your own camera?
Oh, that's not before I know him.
Oh.
Here's the CI organizing camp. There's Martin.
Oh,
there's Van, what's his name?
Van
Arthur.
Yeah. Gus Hall?
I don't know if he's there, but he's here.
Here.
Right for my finger.
Oh.
I was director on the range.
What happened to Van
Arthur?
He's in Chicago somewhere. I don't know what he's doing. I haven't heard from him for years.
Here's another one. Because they're all there. Martin and Gus then.
You see that labor sports down there?
Well, here's just
this
a snapshot of it. We had
part
a big,
of it. This is only part of it.
We had a big picture. It's around somewhere.
Yeah, I
just can't find it right now.
That's only part of it.
And here's another little one of it, too.
Yeah.
Well, here's part of our YCL group. See Red Carson in the front there? We're on our way to Duluth to some convention of ours.
Ricky has one like
this. Does he? Oh!
Yeah. Yeah. With the Red Army, there used to be some real revolutionary plays, you know, that they would put on about the Finnish Civil War.
Yeah.
You know, against the Manuel and his gang, you know.
Yeah.
The whites against the reds.
Mm-hmm.
And oh, there have been a number of plays written about that war.
But you had one, this one five-act play. What the heck was, what was the name of it?
I don't know.
That big one, oh, gosh.
See, I can't remember the names of the plays that
there were so many of them.
What was it about?
Oh, I don't quite recall now. There's a Red Army play.
Yeah,
you were playing the leading character.
Red Army soldier and the different ones would get killed in the play. And
which
was so sad. They were all so sad. They had people crying all the time, you know.
Yeah.
And, weren't there a lot of Monaghan's skins on the range after 20?
Oh, yeah. Well, all that.
Well, there was quite a few. Yeah, there's a number of. see the.
There were so many, but there were some like the Cupolas and the Red.
Yeah, there was a number of. You see, the fins had developed during the earlier period. You know, the during the Finnish Civil War, the fins migrated here, but they were mainly the red fins, you see, and then they developed.
When was that?
Oh, 1916.
Before the
French Revolution? 1916, 1917, you know, during the Finnish Revolution, which took place at the same time as the Russian Revolution. Well, right about that period, 1917, 1918, they migrated down to the range, see. Oh, wait a minute. No, I'm mistaken. Not during that period. 1906 Revolution, you know, the first Kerensky Revolution, you know. The Finns migrated down to the range, a lot of them, and they established committees in all the communities. And they then when the regular civil war took place in 1916, 1917, it was mainly between the reds and the whites. See? So they established committees, and anybody who migrated here had to go to the committee to establish themselves in the community. And anybody who was on the white side had to get out of the community. They couldn't establish the red control. And they had these red committees all over. They chased anybody who was fought on the white side to get out. But then later during the cooperative struggle, well, then it split, you see, and then there was, you know, the right and the left. It was a very sharp struggle. Tremendous. It was really sharp. Oh, they got so sharp. I remember I had meetings. There used to be fist fights, chairs flying all over. God, it was terrific.
Well, we haven't got to that yet.
No, you haven't. No, you haven't seen anything. I was in this thing, and I was still young then. When I was mainly on the resolutions committee. I introduced the resolutions. Socialist Opera, we used to have the meetings there. I introduced the resolutions.
What meeting?
A cooperative meeting. You know, the creamery.
Oh,
and
during
other,
the split, yeah.
Yeah, during the split. And I introduced meetings, you know, resolutions. And of course, we had the majority all the time, and we fought them through, you know, just bulldozed them through, you know. It was really interesting. When I think back, you know, it was really sectarian.
Amongst themselves, like
yeah,
that,
we
you
fought.
Know, it was really terrible. Instead of trying to unify them, they were at each other's throats.
So this division has taken place over the years. Since that time, it got so bitter and sharp that it never has healed, really. It's been a real struggle to heal that.
Well, they have their own sickness and their own
grief. Yeah.
And we have our own.
It's all been, for years now, I've been trying to heal it, but I